Welcome back to Remember What's Next, Season 3. This is the podcast where we explore the intersection of Jewish history and modern-day challenges. I'm Ellie Bass, a Jewish educator, healer, and coach, and joining me once again is Rabbi Ken Spiro. He's an author, educator, and world-renowned Israel tour guide and historical pundit. In this season, we'll be examining the vital importance of Jewish unity. Throughout history, the Jewish people have faced countless obstacles and challenges, yet have always managed to survive and thrive due to their unity and sense of collective purpose when we can muster it. We'll examine the clashes and collaborations between ancient traditions and modern innovations and explore how these interactions can shape a better future for everyone. We're jumping into the unique challenges and opportunities facing the Jewish community in the modern era, and how our unity can help us confront these challenges and build a brighter future for all. So join us on this journey of discussion, learning, and inspiration as we remember the past, discover the present, and explore what's next for the Jewish people. All right. Welcome back, everyone. Rabbi Ken Spiro from Israel. Nice to be back.
Always good to be back. How you doing?
Everything's good. Okay, so we are sort of continuing a little bit from last week where we talked a little bit about, the history of war in general. So today we're going to dig into a little bit more specifically the history of war in Israel. And when we say, when we talk about Israel, we can only think all the way back, right? Because if we talk about biblical war, we certainly have a lot of text that outlines what war looks like from a Jewish standpoint. What is the purpose of it? And then we have to come up to the modern day when you have Israel as a modern democratic state that has its own army, the IDF. And then what does war look like now? So where should we start to understand more deeply the history of war for the Israelites and for Israel, and how does that bring us to where we are today?
Well, there's two ways of looking at it, Ellie. One is kind of the big geopolitical realities of the ancient world, because the Bible tends to kind of micro focus on the events surrounding the Jewish people and who were fighting without necessarily giving us the understanding of what's going on. And the other issue, again, as we sort of touched on in the last podcast, was talking a little bit about the Jewish conception from a purely theoretical halachic perspective on how Judaism looks at wars. You know, we also talked about this last time, that Judaism is the way it is and the way it ought to be. And Judaism is a very practical faith. It has ideals, but it deals with the realities of, you know, sexuality and human relations, of violence. These are things that exist in the world. God gave us a world that is neutral, and, you know, we have these urges pushing us in different directions. And so as to ignore, you know, the notion of war, that's why halacha talks about Jewish law, goes into, okay, this is going to happen. This is how it in a theoretical stage. Doesn't mean go look for wars to practice the halacha in. But when these things happen, and they will, because it's human nature, then this is the way you have to behave. And just to talk maybe a little bit theoretically before we talk about maybe the geopolitical realities of the ancient Near East as reflected in the narrative in the Bible, is that, you know, Judaism defines, when we talk about war, there's two kinds of wars talked about in Jewish law. One is called Milchemet Mitzvah, which is a command war, a war that mitzvah is a commandment. But Milchemet Mitzvah, which the simple version is best expressed by the great medieval philosopher Maimonides, rabbi philosopher Maimonides, who says Milchemet Mitzvah, a commanded war, by the way, from which there are no exemptions. One is the conquest of the land of Israel, which biblically commanded by God from, you know, to God says, Abraham, to your seed, I will give this land. And we, after we leave Egypt, that's what, after 40 years of wandering in the desert, that's, we cross the Jordan and conquer the land of Israel from the Canaanites. That's one. The second is, of course, the war against Amalek, who is the arch enemy of the Jewish people, who is the first people to attack the Jewish people after we leave Egypt, who has a deep-seated animus towards the Jew. They're like the Nazis of the ancient world, who, whenever they get in a position of power, will always try and foist a genocide onto the Jewish people in some way or another. And they're considered our ultimate arch enemy that we can't compromise with. And the third, which is really relevant even today, by the way, most relevant because, you know, we don't have prophets and kings and Jewish government, but, you know, commanding us to go. You can't carry out those first two commandments nowadays. Well, the land of Israel is already under Israel's sovereignty, and Amalekites, we can't. That's not a commandment we can be doing now. But the third is a war to defend Israel from a foreign threat. And that has been the perennial situation that Jews in the land of Israel have found themselves in until today. And in that situation, that's clearly the most obvious one. It's you know, this is a fight for the survival when we're being invaded by an enemy or enemies. And again, in all three of those cases, these are unique status of war that you just go to war. There's no political process required for that. And there's no exemptions from it because everyone's got to fight. The other category is, of course, Milchemet Rishut, which is like a war by permission, which is allowed in Jewish law. It's not something that is encouraged anyway, but in theory it says, right, if a king decides for whatever reason he wants to expand his territory into surrounding territories, he can do that, but with, it's very similar to the US going to war, you have to go to the Congress and ask for a declaration of war. The king has to go to the Sanhedrin and explain why he wants to do it, and then get the backing of the judicial legislative branch of the government to give him permission. Just can't go wildly go conquer stuff all the time. So
I seem to remember, so that's interesting that we even have a provision like that, because when I think through the text that I have studied, which I certainly haven't done as much as you, but even when I think to say what's in Torah and Tanakh, I don't see a lot of wars to expand the empire. It doesn't seem to me that empire building is generally on a Jewish person's list of things to do.
Right. And by the way, King David is the most notable example. He's the ultimate example of a king and a leader of the Jewish world, being a political leader, a military leader, a musician, a prophet, a writer, a scholar, you name it. He's Plato's philosopher king in the flesh. But he, when he is king, who spends a lot of his time fighting, does build a mini empire through subjugating peoples who are living in our territory, like the Philistines, things like that, who are kind of foreign invaders into the land of Israel, living on the coast before we even got there, but they're not the indigenous population either. But also either making political alliances or pacifying surrounding kingdoms, and if necessary, fighting. There's definitely examples. King David is fighting a lot of wars, but that's the exception, not the rule. It's not a Jewish thing. When we look at the Bible, mm-hmm. it's not a Jewish thing to want to conquer. There are people who lived for conquest. Like the Roman Empire usually got in trouble if it wasn't conquering someone. If they weren't fighting someone else, the Roman legion started fighting each other often. Power right. struggles. So Jews are like the only people in the world that I know of in the ancient world today. This is an alien concept. This is one of the problems we have when we try and use our modern sensitivities to judge the ancient world, thinking they thought like we thought. In the ancient world, conquest was the norm. Not to conquer was a sign of weakness. And even when we're told in the Bible by God to conquer, get rid of the Canaanites, they're bad news. You know, if they want to become Noahides and become, you know, Ger Toshav, to live amongst us as people who are now monotheists, but not necessarily Jewish, okay, that's one option. But you cannot let them stay in their current status in the land, because they'll pollute you with their Canaanite immoral ideology and values. The Jewish people, when they stopped the Canaanites, from their perspective, when we enter the land of Israel to conquer it under Joshua, they organize a series of military campaigns to crush us, which is what I would do if I was a Canaanite. And the Jews counterattack and fight them back and conquer Canaanite city after Canaanite city. But when they stop fighting us, we stop fighting them, and we leave pockets of Canaanites in the land of Israel literally for centuries, including Jerusalem, right. which remains a non-Jewish city in the heart of a Jewish country for 440 years. And ultimately, that is going to be bad news, because exactly as, you know, God said through the prophets, you know, if you leave them here, bad news. Their idolatry and their immorality will seep into the Jewish world, because you can't live amongst other peoples without their culture and values influencing you.
Right.
And ultimately will lead to our downfall. So, but we don't like to fight. We have to be told to do it. And even we're told to do it, we don't do it the way we're supposed to do it. Because it's just
right. There's all kinds of examples of Jewish leaders trying to take the more compassionate route out. and negotiating and speaking first. And, you know, even the whole story of, you know, one of the most famous stories, the falling of the walls of Jericho, right? They walk around the city, you know, for weeks, blasting the shofar and trying to just, you know, psychologically navigate that situation before they bust down the walls. Like it seems like in Torah text, if I'm hoping I'm not reading this wrong, but we tend to try everything we can before we have to go to war. Is that accurate?
Well, generally, as we talked about in the last podcast, Jericho, by the way, we walk around 7 days around the wall blowing the shofar, and then the walls come down, and then we go in and conquer the city and wipe out the occupants, sparing a few specific people that are specifically mentioned there, because that's a city that refused to surrender and refused to leave and didn't do anything. So that was the consequences we talked about. And Joshua's sending a series of messages to the Canaanites of, first, you can leave if you want. You can submit to Jewish rule and drop your Canaanite idolatry. Or if you stay and fight, it's a fight to the finish. And that's what happens in that city. So generally speaking, in that specific situation, the conquest is total, and it's all out war. And even when, by the way, it's an interesting side point, even when miraculous things happen, there's always direct fighting involved. It's always this combination. There's a miraculous collapse of their fortifications, but then we still have to go in and fight the Canaanites, the Jerichoites, who are in the city itself.
So how do we not see ourselves then as a conquering power if that's what we're doing?
Well, first of all, look, there's no question. To say otherwise, the Jewish people conquered the land of Israel militarily. And as I said, I always say this, I said the only people more indigenous to the land of Israel are Canaanites. They don't exist anymore. I mean, we wiped out a lot of them, and the rest of them just disappeared, as most ancient nations did. But again, this is the, so people are like, but then if you live in America and you're not a Native American, you're a part of, you live in Canada, every place in the world. And it's not like the, you know, you go to Northern Italy and those are the original Italian people. They're mostly Germanic people up there, which is why if you go to Northern Italy, there are a lot more blondes there than in Sicily. Right. So every place in the world, we just don't appreciate how much conquest there was in the world. Expansion of territory, land being the most valuable thing there is in this world, and being your greatest source of wealth is to have own land. It's been a ubiquitous practice throughout all of human history, literally until, as we talked about last week, the Judeo-Christian concepts of the notion of ethics and warfare and peace in the UN, even though it has failed to do it, adopting the notion of an international body that's going to strive so we don't have any wars, so that these wars we had are the wars that end all other future wars. So that's a very, very modern construct. So yes, Jews definitely did conquer the land of Israel. There are definitely battles in the Bible. There are situations later in Jewish history where parts of the land of Israel are reconquered to reestablish Jewish sovereignty over territory. A great example is Yochanan Hyrcania, John Hyrcanus, who's one of the Maccabean rulers after the revolt, who goes down to the southern part of what used to be Israel, now occupied by the Edomites, who moved in after the country was denuded of its Jewish population with the destruction of the first temple. And he says, look, this is our territory. We're expanding our land. And if you want to stay, you got to convert to Judaism. It's the only real, it's not a forced conversion, but it's like, you want to stay, you got to be Jewish. You can be an Edomite, but you got to leave. So we do have instances of that, but they're few and far between in Jewish history. And in the modern times, especially with Israel, okay, initially in the early years of the state, if we can zoom forward literally thousands of years, all Israel's wars are always defensive wars. And the only example I know of Israel seizing, even though Israel could easily, especially now, because the strength of Israel's military has gone up exponentially to be huge, where there's no Arab army anywhere around us can really challenge Israel in an all-out knock down, straight out fight. That's why we have this asymmetrical warfare with people who don't have air forces or armor or navies hiding in tunnels, whether it's Hezbollah or Hamas, and shooting rockets and doing terrorist attacks and things like that. But Israel could easily, if it wanted to, like take over Lebanon. It could go right through Hezbollah and take over Lebanon. And if Hezbollah wasn't there, it would
Wait,
be like-
Even though like that, all of those territories are twice or three times the size, much larger populations. Like, why is that?
Because again, it's not the Jewish thing to do. The only example I could think of in modern history is when the Palestinian Liberation Organization, you know, was pushed out in Black September 1970 from Jordan, where and when the Jordanians killed thousands of Palestinians and expelled them, and they went to South Lebanon and destabilized that very stable, very delicately balanced, you know, Maronite, Christian, Druze, Shiite, Sunni, very interesting mix, Lebanon, artificial, you know, state created by the French after World War II, you know, they started launching attacks from that. Before Hezbollah, there was the PLO launching rockets, and Israel went in 1982 and pushed the PLO back and then occupied a security buffer zone within international territory of Lebanon. And that was held until the 2000 when Israel pulled back. Of course, the other obvious example of Israel in 1967, Israel took the Judean Samaria and Gaza back from Jordan, which was illegally occupying it, and Egypt, which was illegally occupying Gaza. And that territory, this is what they call the, you know, the Palestinian territory, was never a, that's a whole nother, you know, discussion, but that territory was never anything. It was supposed to be, it was designated as an Arab state in 48, but because the Arabs didn't accept the partition and tried to destroy Israel, it never became anything. It went from being Jordanian occupied to Israeli territory, but it's not really occupied because it's no one else's country. It's a disputed piece of real estate whose status is in limbo. But this also happened in Egypt when the Egyptians tried to destroy Israel in 67, and Israel pushed them way back to the Suez Canal. So Israel has definitely taken territory, but always as a defensive measure. And Israel has always withdrawn from territories that are clearly the international territory of another recognized state, which would be the buffer zone in Lebanon and would be the Sinai, south of the Negev Desert in Israel.
Right. So what you're saying is, let me just say it back so I understand, even when they've won territory in war and then established that territory as a security buffer, in the end, that territory is usually given back to the sovereign nation that it, you know, is internationally recognized to belong to. So they've given back that southern territory of Lebanon and that northern territory of Sinai back to Egypt and back to Lebanon, because Israel doesn't necessarily want or need extra land in that way. You know, it's more just about, we just need our house that we can live in and survive in. We don't need the neighborhood. Is that accurate?
More or less. And it's also the Golan Heights is the other example I forgot to mention, which was Syrian control that should have been given to Israel in the original when the French and the British were working it out. It made more logical sense that Israel have it, but Syria is using it to shoot down on the Sea of Galilee and the Esbat HaGalil, the Galilee finger, the upper Galilee farmlands and what seemed there. So Israel got that target. That's the example that Israel's held on to. Israel got very close to several occasions under Clinton. They're going to sign a peace agreement. Israel would give it back to Syria and it would be demilitarized. And literally the day before Clinton was going to fly like to Switzerland to sign, Assad Sr., who's now dead, his son is now the dictator who runs what's left of Syria, he raised the demands to an impossible demand and forced Israel to say no, because what they was asking for was something that was beyond what Israel would ever agree to. And he deliberately did that. But basically, it's unique in that Israel is the only country in the world in modern history that fights wars it doesn't start for its survival. So it's not the aggressor. It's the defensive party in every single struggle. It wins the wars, and then it is treated as if it lost the wars and has to give up territory.
Right.
Which is penalizing for a war of aggression it did not start.
Wild.
Israel gives up the territory for peace. It's also unique. It's a unique formula only used with Israel, the land for peace formula. Usually it's peace for peace. You want to compromise on something? Here's, you give back stuff and we'll give you our word, which is sometimes maybe kind of held too. So that, but the basic thing to focus on here, going back to what we're talking about, is yes, Israel has definitely been involved in many wars throughout its history, whether they're thousands of years ago in the time of the Canaanites or King David, or in modern history, but it's just not in Jewish nature to be belligerent and warlike and to be building empires and expanding. I always jokingly say the only Jewish empire in history has been Hollywood. And that's not a source of Jewish values either.
And not even that anymore.
Yeah, exactly.
Interestingly enough, I think, you know, what comes to mind when we talk about this also is the extreme discomfort of Jews identifying themselves these days as warriors, right? Like we usually focus on, you know, Hanukkah could be a very different holiday. We focus on the oil and the latkes and the miracles, but it's also a story of, you know, a small rebel group of people over 25 years managing to push off an entire empire just so that we could practice Judaism and continue to maintain our cultural and religious, you know, people. So I think it's interesting that we are very uncomfortable as Jews with the idea of ourselves as warriors and militarily powerful. And we've been struggling to try to reconcile that as Jews in the diaspora with the IDF. It brings up lots of weird, uncomfortable feelings. And I think about, you know, when people say, oh, all Jews are from Europe. And then we look at what's been built in Israel. It's a real, you know, we're seen as sort of like the people of the book that went like lambs to the slaughter in the Holocaust. And it's hard for people to hold. At the same time, now we are the Israel Defense Force, which is considered one of the most efficient and effective armies in the world.
Yeah, but that's the whole historical process. I mean, I always say the real... We're not comfortable with it because, again, it's not in our spiritual DNA.
Got it.
You know, that there's the famous statement of the rabbis that Jews are Rachmanim, Baishanim, Vegom Lechasidim. That's the Jewish personality. It doesn't mean all Jews are that way. It doesn't mean non-Jews can't be that way. But Jews are basically, they're merciful.
How does that translate?
Modest, and they like to do good stuff for the world. Sorry?
Right. So merciful, modest.
Baishan is like a Baishan is someone who's like embarrassed, but it's like Jews aren't really, there's some very flamboyant Jews. God knows there are, but we're not out there. It's not like we're kind of behind the scenes people more in history. And Gom Lechasidim are people who like to do good. And God knows that's the Jewish obsession is fixing the world and Jews for every ism, but Judaism in every cause. So it doesn't really fit into our DNA, but we should also understand that because Jews are so highly ideologically motivated people, historically, if you read like Josephus's account of the Great Revolt, Jews are crazy fighters, like the Japanese in the Pacific. Because we believe so strongly in our beliefs, we're the first people, the Hanukkah story being the classic example of dying for your beliefs. People who are, you know, who are highly motivated by ideology and are fighting for something really, you know, mercenaries always are the worst soldiers because they're fighting for pay and nothing else. And when it hits the fan, they're going to probably run away to save their skin. But people are fighting for their farm, their family, their belief, their existence are the most highly motivated people. So Jews are actually, if you read the accounts of Josephus's Jewish War, which is the great Roman military campaign of the Great Revolt between 66 and 70, ending with the Masada story in 73, there's a lot of descriptions of Jews being really very like crazy valiant fighters. And you mentioned the Hanukkah story, which we're not so familiar with because, first of all, it doesn't appear in our Bible. Several books, there are multiple books of the Maccabees, but 1st and 2nd Maccabees, which were written by, one is written by a chronicler of the Hasmonean dynasty, the Maccabean royal priestly dynasty, are accounts of the military campaign written from the Jewish perspective by people who are on the side of the Jewish people who are working even for the Maccabean authorities. And the battles are pretty unbelievable, like pretty gutsy stuff. You know, Alexander the Great would have been impressed by them, you know, against all odds, crazy suicidal things. So while maybe Jews aren't physically the largest people, we're not. You want to see really intimidating warriors, look at the Vikings. You know, Holland till today is the largest. Tallest people in the world live in Holland. The average height of a man is 6 feet high. Look at the Vikings of Northern Europe. These people were physically very, very warlike. By the way, they lived for war. Their whole idea of the world to come was basically spending eternity drinking and fighting and doing other things we're not going to talk about.
Right.
But Valhalla, go read about Valhalla. But they were just big. It's not a Jewish thing to be physically large and necessarily aggressive. But what you mentioned is the diaspora experience. Once we lost our country and we're living as minority, often persecuted people in other lands. Well, there are exceptions to this, by the way. There are Jews fighting, not just in modern history and armies, as soon as they were given citizenship, but we have examples of Jews fighting as mercenaries for other countries, even in the ancient world, for the Egyptians and Elephantine, and allying themselves with their hosts to fight foreign invaders and countries. But we haven't whatever military culture we had was long since lost by 2000 years of diaspora, when in many places we're not allowed to be armed. And we're just, when we reconstitute.
Yeah, and we're just constantly the smallest religious minority in whatever country we're living in. And so really for us, everything has been about, can we just survive this experience? Can we just stay alive? And certainly in absolutely no position in order to be able to fight for ourselves. I think probably that's one of the reasons I wonder if why the Warsaw ghetto uprising became so, you know, legendary. So in Jewish history, where Jews fought back.
Yeah, it's a bit, but I know I was talking the sheep to the slaughter analogy, which is often used for the Holocaust. Like I saw someone sent me this split image once of it's like a bunch of Jews running to a pit to be shot by Nazis. It says Jews 1942. And then it shows a bunch of IDF, like Golani soldiers running into combat, you know, Jews 2014. And it's a very nice image, but it's not the sheep to the slaughter thing is not necessarily is a very unfair in many cases way of judging the Jewish people when you're dealing with a major, you know, a military force hurting civilian, unarmed civilians to somewhere. To why aren't they fighting back? What are you going to do? You know, there's many. This is not unique to Jews. You have so many examples of armies coming into villages and towns. And you look at the Death March in the Bataan when the Philippines fell, you know, to the Japanese after Pearl Harbor, and you see just this amazing scene of, as far as you can see, thousands of Philippine soldiers and a lot of American soldiers who were, and every 50 feet there's a Japanese guy with his gun on his shoulder walking. You know, like these guys were broken. They were exhausted, starved, and surrendered. And they're marching. They could have, in theory, they could have all turned on their Japanese guards because they were outnumbered on probably 25-1 or more. But they, you know, it's not a fair assessment. But because this is whole another discussion, we can have it another time. But because of modern Zionist worldview of creating kind of retro, going back to the fighting, farming, ancient Hebrews, as opposed to the ghettoized, beaten down diaspora Jew who right. had no pride. No, it's a very unfair assessment, very one-sided. But that much of the ethos around things like the Warsaw Ghetto comes from this kind of modern revisionist way of looking at now we've created a new fighting Jew, which is why so much was put on the Masada rebels who chose death rather than slavery, the famous speech that's recorded in Josephus, or the Warsaw Ghetto, where these Jews rose up in revolt. The first organized revolt against the Nazis was the Warsaw Ghetto uprising.
Right.
So it kind of became the model for what we have to do now. We want to reclaim our homeland. We have to get back to our homeland. We have to get back to fighting biblical spirit, which tended also to taint how they looked at the characters of the Bible. Ironically, interestingly enough, the secular Zionist movement, and I'm a huge Zionist, it's not the issue, but the secular Zionist movement tended to glorify people like the Maccabees and King David as warrior kings because they fought. And we have examples of them being very valorous and very gutsy in their fighting. Mm-hmm. But they forget that these were very holy warriors. They were fighting with a very specific religious ideology, the Maccabees especially. Were, you know, fighting to save Judaism from foreign right. pagan influence. So they kind of colored it with their own brush to suit the kind of worldview. But what's really interesting is, yes, with the return to the land of Israel, which is a country that was born in the ashes of the Holocaust and has been in a constant state of alternating warfare and or terrorism or both at the same time, we have had to relearn how to create a military culture. But nonetheless, if you look at the IDF, all ridiculous lies, fake news, and propaganda aside, there is no army that behaves with more moderation, self-restraint, humanity, even to its own detriment of like warning people in advance, we're going to blow up your building and right. not bombing because we don't want to hurt civilians when our own soldiers are going to die because we're going to go house to house like we're seeing in Gaza. So the point is you can't take the Jew out of the soldier in an Israeli army, whether it's thousands of years ago or today. We didn't want to fight in Joshua's time. We were being right. too merciful back then. You could argue that we're being too merciful today. You could say that, you know, but that is the unique Jewish way of warfare. That it's a reality of life. We're commanded to do it, but we're given very specific rules of how we have to behave, even in what is arguably the most horrible situation that human beings could find themselves in.
So how do we trace a little bit? Is there a common thread that runs all the way through the Jewish history of warfare from the biblical times to the modern times?
Yeah, so once we, the initial conflict is, of course, the physical conquest of the land of Israel. But then what we see, and this really literally carries on until modern times, is, Israel's location geographically. And when I teach history, I always say before you go into the micro and the details, you have to pull out. You got to get the big geographic picture, the bigger historical picture, the bigger economic, geopolitical reality picture. Israel, it's not called the Middle East for nothing. I always say it's a blessing and a curse where we end up. If, being where we are and the world's geographies, the world's a much bigger place and it's much more spread out, and you have huge cradles of civilization that interact with each other spread around the globe. But, the earliest civilizations are based in the Middle East, in Mesopotamia, which is the area of Iraq, which there are multiple civilizations, Assyria, Babylonia, Persia, and to the northeast of Israel, and then south, the great ancient civilization of Egypt. Now, they're no longer the hubs of high-tech innovation. They got some oil coming out of a few places, but they're not what they used to be. But Israel's sandwiched right in terms of the history, especially of the Western world, right in the middle, which the blessing is, if we're supposed to be the middlemen who are bringing these transformative ideas of one God, one absolute morality to the world, we're right in the middle of these empires to be able to influence the earliest civilization from the dawn of civilization, which is going back literally, we're talking about 4,000 years ago. And also for commerce, it's great to be in a place where everyone's moving through your territory and you can, run trade routes, shipping going out of there and
Meaning
stuff.
like Israel is kind of like a linchpin in between like Asia, Africa, and the Middle East. Like it's sort of really that linchpin that's right in between all of those much larger empires and connects all of them in some way.
Exactly. It's a land bridge, like what the other great land bridge in this part of the world is the Bosporus. It's what Turkey is of today, of the Byzantium, which was the, if you go to Istanbul, one side of the bridge is called the European side, and one side of the bridge is called the Asian side. So these critical routes that where you control not only ports and access to the Mediterranean, but also land travel routes, like the great trade route, the Via Maris, that runs up the coast of Israel, which enables people to cross into the northern part of Israel and go to Damascus and Syria via land and things like that, and go down south and go to Egypt and go down to, so it's, but the curse of it is when you're located in the middle of great civilizations, you're strategically in a very valuable piece of real estate.
Got it.
And that means I always like I you know I say they, I, my joke definition it's like my joke definition of Belgium. I hope no Belgians are listening. I always say it's the country used by Germany to invade France.
It's like
So
it's the doorway.
If you're reading the stories in the Bible, especially in the book of like Kings and stuff, initially there's a lot of countries around us that we're fighting, we're having border wars with, and territorial struggles, and the Assyrians emerge, and the Canaanite group appears here, and the Philistines are down there. So a lot of it is kind of local struggles between smaller groups of people fighting over control of or expansion of territory, and we're sandwiched in between those. But when these empires appear, and Egypt is a very ancient empire, and then you start getting empires to the northeast, first the Assyrians, the Babylonians, and the Persians. A lot of the background to these stories you read about, King Hezekiah and what's going on with Sennacherib and the Babylonians and Nebuchadnezzar have to do with a much more global picture of empire expansion, which often the meeting point of empires, like is often battles between Egypt, which is in the south and never changes hands. It's always Egypt. And the Assyrians, the Hittites, they're fighting different peoples, and often the battleground will be the land of Israel. The story of Josiah being killed because the Egyptians want to pass. Pharaoh Necho says, "I just want to pass through your territory to go fight these guys in the north." And Josiah says, "I can't let a foreign army invade." And he goes out to stop Pharaoh Necho, and he dies in battle. So a lot of it has to do with us just being caught between the rise and fall of many different empires. So we get to interact with them all. So if you know your Jewish history, you know who is an empire when. But that will spill over because once you get past that period of early empires, then you go into the emergence of European empires in the Middle East. The entire early Jewish history, all the way through the First Temple period, we're only interacting with people who are our neighbors and often linguistically and culturally very similar to us, especially when we deal with that area called Mesopotamia, because the Assyrian, Babylonian, and Persian civilizations are really close neighbors and culturally very connected to us. We begin our history coming out of Iraq. That's where Abraham's from. But once the Europeans appear, then you have a much then the as the world becomes larger because the empires become that much bigger. The Greeks, for instance, Alexander the Great's remarkable 10-year military campaign where he conquers, he dismembers the Persian Empire, gets all the way out to India, takes a little beeline down south, goes all the way through Lebanon of today and Israel of today, Alexander the Great, and getting to, you know, Egypt. So that Eastern Mediterranean will become part of that Greek Empire, which doesn't really outlast Alexander because it's divided amongst other Greek generals. But when you get to the mid-first century of the Common Era, Rome is already the great expanding empire of this part of the world. And the Romans will not only subsume the Greeks into their empire, but they will take over by the time you get to 2,000 years ago, around the Pax Romana period. They will control the entire Mediterranean. So all of these, and we're into, and every one of these times, you look at the, if you look at that big picture and you do two parallel timelines, you'll see that, okay, now we're fighting with these people. Initially, it was our local neighbors in smaller wars, and sometimes there's a big empire involved, and then it gets bigger and bigger, 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 and we're dealing with everyone. But basically, we are, from our perspective, this is the whole story. From their perspective, we're often this little fly. You know, the Romans found the Jews to be extremely annoying people because they rebelled more than anyone else. But in the vast picture of what was an empire that was all of most of Europe, North Africa, the Middle East, Turkey, you know. So, but this is the reality. But what's driving all of these wars at this period of time is basically a colonial idea. And colonialism is something, again, with the revisionist crazy world we have today of people who don't know a lot but are very big on opinions and short on their knowledge of history and everything else. It's a white aggression thing. No, everyone is an imperialist in human history. Every people who has an opportunity to do so will do so, whether it's all around China or the Japanese, you name it. They're doing it in Europe, in Asia, they're doing it in Africa, the Zulu were doing it, you know, they're doing it, the Incas, the Mayas, the Aztecs, everyone does this. So the kinds of empires, they come and go, but this is, the struggle is basically over the idea of it seems to be innate in the personality of much of the rest of the world, not the Jewish people, to really want to expand, because that just gives you, your power comes from the land you control, and that gives you your strategic power, your ability to control trade routes, ability to access natural resources and food supplies and things like that. So that's what's driving these struggles. They're not. So when Israel is fighting, with the exception of like the Hanukkah story, which is, starts out as a civil war amongst assimilated Jews sicking the Greeks on their fellow Jews. They're pretty much just Israel trapped in someone else's empire and suffering the consequences of that, which means there's not really a lot of ideology behind it, which also means, generally speaking, that because when people, with the exception of people like the Mongols, who were just in many ways very inclusive, who they allowed in their army, but in many ways so incredibly destructive, just wanton destruction, it's in the best interest of most empires, like the Romans, we conquer you, and if you submit, we'll leave you alone, just pay your taxes. Let us station our government officials and our army there. And remember who's in charge. It's a win-win. You get the stability of being in our empire. You get our roads and our aqueducts and our laws and our great culture and all that other good stuff. And, you know, that's the kind of situation. Jews have tended to be kind of indigestible to other cultures. So it's often led to, you know, wars and revolts.
Right. Meaning we're willing to live under certain rule, but when that rule starts to tell us that we're not allowed to practice Judaism and connect and have a relationship with our God and our people in the way that we do, we have a problem with that. And then, you know, we become the issue.
Exactly.
I think, it's, as I hear you talk, it makes me think, especially being in North America, where most people think that their food comes from the grocery store. I think this idea of land being the ultimate sustainer of a civilization is really not viscerally understood. And if you understand that if you have land, your people will survive because your food comes from the land, your water comes from the land, then you understand why land becomes such a big deal. I think a lot of people now would look at the idea of like, oh, fighting over a piece of land is an ideological colonial you know, fight, whereas like, no, like this was, it used to be about, if you don't have land, you don't survive. You can't live. You can't, you know, you can't Instacart your groceries to wherever you are from wherever they come from, because there's just nothing like that. So I think we have a very disconnected and privileged idea of what war is about, because we don't understand that if you don't have land, you can't live.
Exactly. And oh, by the way, all early struggles, the earliest are like tribal wars over a water hole or something like that, or migrating. Right. It's only with a byproduct of, you know, it's only when you domesticate crops and animals and you start to get a surplus of food and population can grow and cities are built and the stratification of society, especially you can develop a professional warrior class, because not everyone's a farmer. Even the Greeks, their army was, there were farmer soldiers most, except for Sparta. Sparta was a pure militarized culture where slaves did all the agriculture and kids were raised from age 7 to be warriors. You just learn to fight or you die. You literally didn't fight at certain times of the year, like in the fall and in the spring. This is harvesting and planting time, so there's no fighting then. There was campaign season, then you have to go back, put your sword down, and take up your plow. So the analogy of swords into plowshares is much more, when you understand the famous Isaiah quote, now you understand it better. But you're right. We live in a world that is based on certain ideologies of trying to live in peace with similar worldviews, a world of tremendous prosperity, a world of international trade, and a world where we've been able to create food to such an abundance, especially in the Western world, that we don't appreciate the subsistence level existence that many people lived in for much of history, which is the driving force behind a lot of conflict. But once you get past that, then it just becomes a matter of greed. I can, I do, I take it as I can. Not to conquer is a sign of weakness.
Right.
So there's not a lot of...
But it seems like Israel's in a unique position, because if we think about the fact that Israel does not import any of its food, other than, I think, is this right? Wheat and meat. Everything else is like grown locally. Like, so it has the ability to self-sustain on a massive level, which many countries don't have. So its need to build an empire or to expand past its territories in order to get essentials is not necessary. We have imports now. They can import wheat and they can import meat and everything else they grow themselves. So why would they need other land? That's just more governance.
Right. But it's not just, but I think nowadays in modern wars, it's been much less about that. And even in the ancient world, the Roman Empire's primary drive for land wasn't the wheat of Egypt was what fed the Roman Empire. It was exported, you know, became part of the empire. They would just, Egypt had to provide a huge amount of wheat. It's just the desire. It's an innate human drive. It's aggression is uniquely male. It's the male trait that women don't have. They're aggressive women, but they're the few and far between, which probably explains why, you know, there's less women CEOs, because the traits that it requires to be a killer in business are more innate. Despite what some people think that men and women are the same, I don't want to get into that discussion now at all, but there are certain traits that are innately highly focused in the male personality, and aggression and fighting and things like that, even amongst animals in mating season, you see it all the time. So it's just kind of like when you get a civilization that believes, that has developed into a superior civilization that believes that it's its destiny to spread its roots around the world, that's done through conquest, not through cultural imperialism is a different thing. You know, I'm going to export my ideas and my values and my taste in food to other people. That's an economic, a different endeavor altogether. But this notion, like Hitler is not conquering necessarily, you know, Europe because he wants more food. He wants more land to expand for the German people to spread out. And because it was an ideological idea that we need to subjugate, it is our destiny. This is the idea that really begins much more early in history than Hitler and the Nazis. The Japanese had this, we are the superior people and it is our right and our destiny to either, if we don't destroy, at least to conquer and subjugate other peoples whose job it is to basically give us stuff and serve us and work for us. So, and again, this is what's driving a lot of the empires in human history, when they're not fighting defensive wars, offensive wars to expand their empires. But again, they're not based on ideologies more than we are superior, we're strong, you're weak, I'm big, you're small, you don't like it, I kill you. And that's just the way of the world, because that's the way the animal kingdom works. There's no mercy in nature. Nature is brutal, but nature is balanced.
But then that also fits why Judaism isn't into that, like why Jews aren't into that, because Judaism very specifically is not into, we're not allowed to proselytize. We're not allowed to try to make everybody Jewish. That's not the point of what we're up to. And we're not interested in it. Everybody has their own path. If you choose to be Jewish, it's you got to go through hoops to get there. You're allowed in, but we don't have an idea of the world that eventually everyone's supposed to be Jewish. That is not Torah idea. And I think that plays into then our not being interested in empire building. If we have the resources we have, we don't need to try to make the whole world into something that it's not. And I think that maybe takes us to something that we're going to talk about next week in terms of the colonization of the Middle East. What does that mean and what does that look like? And a difference between, say, Christianity and Islam in waging wars of everybody is eventually supposed to be Christian, or everybody's eventually supposed to be Muslim, or everybody's eventually supposed to be German or Japanese or whatever that is. Like, Jews and Israelis just have no concept of like, yeah, everybody's supposed to be Jewish or everybody's supposed to be Israeli. That's ridiculous.
Yeah. Well, first of all, I would say, to qualify your comment, that most colonialist expansions are not about, this is the theological expansion of, well, let's spread our beliefs around the world, is a very relatively new phenomenon in human history, primarily pushed forth by Islam and Christianity to a certain extent in a slightly different way that maybe we'll say for a different conversation. But in the ancient world, empire was not about, like, the Germans were not about, let's conquer Russia and make them German. These people are inferior. They're Slavs. They had their whole pseudo hierarchy of race. And the Japanese were the same thing. You know, other Asian peoples are not this. They're not the weird. So it was about subjugation of other people, and very little or no interest in any way bringing those people into, like, let's make them like our culture. Let's make them like us. No, not at all. That defeats the purpose. Then they got to get the same rights and privileges as us. Better to keep them as subjugated people or enslaved on some level, and we can milk them for everything they got, because that's our right, because we're just on a higher level than them. So you don't see in human history, the Greeks are the only people who were like, let's make you Greek, but our culture is great. And here, let's bring our cultural things into your world, like our idea of city planning and our idea of architecture and whatever. But it wasn't forcing it down people's throats. It was just, if you have a culture that's sophisticated, people are going to want to copy it. But what you're talking about there is the idea of, you know, Jews were not, one of the reasons why we're Jews, like we said, we've talked about this already during this whole podcast, Jews are not like physically aggressive people. We're intellectually aggressive people, by the way. I always say the Jewish empire has never been an empire of power and land. It's been an empire of ideas. So when it comes to not through conversion and forcing people to believe, but we believe very strongly what we believe in, it's just not in the Jewish personality to be that aggressive and that expansionist for purely economic or power reasons. So, but and as you pointed to correctly, we definitely want to spread our ideas around the world, but it's never been about conquering and forcing people to believe what we believe. Right. And we see Christianity and Islam that are offshoots of Judaism. Each of them in their own way will take that in a different direction, which will color much of the nature of warfare, which becomes much more ideological in modern history than I believe it was in the ancient world. Sure, every culture believed they were the superior culture, and obviously that's the kind of thing, but the ideologically driven conflict, I think, is a much bigger thing in the world today.
Yeah, for sure. Yeah, look, level. I mean, even just in North America, you know, there's an ideological war going on between the left and the right, between, you know, where, you know, no, our values are better. No, our values are better. And we're the ones that should rule the roost, et cetera, et cetera. And it becomes so polarized that it literally is at this point, you know, it's two opposing armies on either side of the way that, you know, here's how our culture should go. So I think you're right. Ideologically, that's really the flashpoint these days, because we have enough resources. We're not fighting over food.
Exactly. And that means that the nature of all conflicts that Israel fights thousands of years after we conquered the land of Israel and come back and resettle our homeland and build up an army are on a completely different level of conflict than they were before. It's no longer fighting empires. The great empires that created the modern Middle East, for better and often for worse, have pulled out. And now we're back to, in many ways, more of the local struggles that we had in the ancient world with more, you know, like local powers that surround us. But again, it's not about just fighting over a border dispute or wanting to expand our territory. They're much more ideological and political in nature than anything we see in the ancient world, which makes them much more difficult to understand what's going on and much more easy to oversimplify an explanation for why they're happening, which means to get a sense of what drives the conflict in the Middle East and all the nuances of what goes into understanding what's going on. It's a whole big discussion of itself, which is completely overlooked because no one today in, first of all, forget that people just don't know history at all,
right,
which is why we do the podcast, because, you know, they're not learning from the past. They certainly don't invest the time in understanding the modern, you know, geopolitical and religious realities of what is driving in the Middle East conflict today, which is much more to do with Israel and Gaza and the Palestinians. It's,
right.
It's a multifaceted, extremely complex conflict that spills into many other areas besides just military power and control of a specific geographic part of the world.
So let's go into that next week. Let's dig into, because I do think that there is a huge misconception that the war between the Palestinians and Israel is over land. We have clearly seen that that's not the case, that it is much more an ideological war. And if people keep thinking that it's about land, they're going to miss the point entirely and not understand what's going on. So next week, let's dig into what is the ideological war that's going on in the Middle East, and the history of that in terms of the colonization of the Arab world and the Middle East, like in general. That would be super helpful, I think, to give us an idea of what's going on and what we're in the middle of right now, which maybe people aren't necessarily aware of, which would be helpful.
And by the way, you said perfectly, missed the point, but it's much more serious than that, because it's like misdiagnosing a disease. Not only would the average person reading his newspaper or reading something online or listening miss it, but entire nations and international bodies will completely not understand what is really going on, and therefore completely fail in their ability to end the conflicts, because you're just not dealing with what the real issues are.
I think it will help us understand why there are now pro-Palestinian protests at Christmas decorations and Santa parades and, you know, all of these kinds of things. Like, wait, what does that have to do with Israel? If people don't understand the ideological war that's that's happening, then they won't understand why it's looking the way it does.
Exactly. And Rick, it spills out of the Middle East into the rest of the world. The misunderstandings also, especially.
Okay.
You got to get close.
All right. So next week, we'll pick it up there. Again, thank you so much, Rabbi Canspiro from Israel. Super, super helpful. Anyone that's listening, please don't forget to like, share, subscribe, or follow. Please let people know if you know anyone that you think would benefit from any of our conversations. If you have a chance to look back, there's 3 seasons worth of history conversations speaking to all different parts of Jewish history. So please go ahead and make sure that you share us out there with your friends. And if you have ideas for topics or things that you'd like us to be talking about right now, please get in touch with us in the liner notes. Thanks everyone for joining.
Thanks for joining us on Remember What's Next. If you would like to get more resources and information about Rabbi Ken Spiro, please check out his website at www.kenspiro.com. If you have a question or an idea for a topic, please email us at rememberwhatsnext@gmail.com.